One of the things that I've missed most in the pandemic is having people over for gatherings. Cameron and I love hosting people. We're lucky to have a huge backyard, a fire pit, a half-decent barbecue, and it makes our space perfect for having people over, especially in the summertime. In fact, it was one of the many reasons we bought the house we're in now. We wanted it to be a place where our family and friends could come together to enjoy each other's company and usually some good food. Of course, COVID has changed all of this. No one has been in our house for almost a full year, aside from lightning-quick bathroom breaks. And to be honest, this has come with some benefits, mainly that we haven't had to be obsessively tidy, although our toddler makes this impossible anyway. Even so, we are longing for the days when we can gather with people again. It's given me a chance to think about the virtue of hospitality and how it shows up in scripture and what that might mean for our post-COVID life. To be honest, when I was a kid, I hated having people over to our house. Don't get me wrong, I'm a social person, but hosting meant that my mom got stressed out and made us spend hours cleaning the house. Often there was yelling, sometimes there were tears, and it all had to be set aside for smiles as soon as the first guest walked in the door. And it's not like we did lots of entertaining of random people we were trying to impress. This was literally just family members, usually the ones who lived in the same town as us. So I didn't understand what the big deal was. So what if my bed wasn't made, or our living room, which no one ever went into, was vacuumed or not? To me, it seemed like a huge waste of time and energy. And now, almost 2 decades later, I have become my mother. I love having friends and family over, but I always get stressed, and I always snap at Cameron because inevitably he's taking a shower or finishing a workout the second before people arrive, instead of being a good partner and cleaning our entire house with me. My reasoning is that I want to be organized and ready to go for when people come over, because then I'll enjoy myself instead of worrying. And I actually seem to recall my mom using the same justifications for her own pre-guest behavior. But at the core, there's something else going on here too. Even if it's just my parents coming over for an afternoon, I want to impress them with how together I have everything. I want to be a good host. So there should be drinks available and food offered, and all of it should be easy without me running around. Because what I've realized is that unfortunately, what I think of as a truly virtuous and beneficial practice, hospitality, it's been very strangely co-opted by good housekeeping rituals. Hosting has become an official role. And it comes with rules, etiquette, and tips for home decorating and meal prep and planning to impress your guests. And this is very, very different from the way that hospitality as an ethic was understood by Jesus in his time. For the Hebrew people and many other cultures at the time, hospitality wasn't just having friends over for fancy dinner parties once a month. Hospitality was the default, it was a way of life. It was a recognition that life was hard and that we couldn't make it on our own. So it was built into religious and cultural codes with obligations for caring for one another. Many of these codes exist to this day and can be found everywhere from Peru to India to Atlantic Canada, to name just a few places where I've experienced this. And we're not just talking about welcoming people you know. Notably, this ethic includes welcoming strangers, especially travelers. So I ask of you, when was the last time you invited strangers into your house, even in a pre-COVID world? The closest I've ever come was letting the cousin of a friend live with us when she moved to the area. She had just gotten a job at the Kitchener Public Library, and she was moving from Northern Ontario. Needed a place for a few weeks while she found her own apartment. So before she arrived, I talked to her once on the phone, trying to figure out what she might be like. So I'm chatting with her and emphasizing that, we have a little kid, that we would be sharing a kitchen, that her bedroom would be in our basement, et cetera, et cetera. She seemed reasonable, but I mean, how much can you really get to know someone over the phone? It all seemed to be okay. And so on the appointed weekend, she pulled up in her car and we were able to finally meet in person. And I helped her move her stuff into our basement. And as soon as I met her, I appreciated how much we had in common. I loved spending the rest of that weekend showing her the prime spots in Uptown Waterloo. We visited For All Ice Cream, we went to Zero Waste Bulk, and 10,000 Villages. That was the first week of March 2020. Ada worked at the library for a week before everything shut down. And suddenly, none of us could leave the house. We scrambled to set up temporary workspaces for Ada and Cameron, and I just tried to stay out of their way and out of their online meetings with a noisy 11-month-old. But I never for a moment regretted that initial burst of hospitality to a person we barely knew. Ada became a fast friend, as one does when you are locked in a house together. We had great conversations in the evening, and the three of us adults enjoyed watching Tiger King when it aired. She loves little kids, and Levi quickly became enamored with her, which gave me some short breaks when I needed to leave the room for a second. She got me into the Great British Bake Off and the Canadian Spinoff, both of which have remained one of my greatest comforts during the pandemic. And when Ada found an apartment for May 1st, after some lengthy and challenging searches, I was genuinely sad to see her go. And I was secretly glad that she needed to come back to our house for the next 3 weeks because it would take that long for her to get Wi-Fi set up in her new apartment. Although Ada was the one who needed a place to live, I was amazed at how much I needed her in the end. She remains a great friend and provided a buffer during those stressful first months of the pandemic that I truly think was helpful for my marriage. We offered her a place to stay, but our relationship with her offered us unexpected benefits, which makes me think that inherent in hospitality is this hidden reciprocity between people. And we hear this message repeated again and again in scripture. We hear about Abraham welcoming strangers into his home, only to realize that they're angels sent by God and who announce that Sarah will give birth to a son. The widow Zarephath offers food and shelter to Elijah, who in turn offers an abundance of oil and meal and raises her son from the dead. And two travelers to Emmaus invite a stranger to join them for a meal, only to discover that he is the risen Jesus. The spiritual writer Henry Nouwen puts this beautifully. He notes that in the practice of hospitality, fearful strangers can become guests, revealing to their hosts the promise they are carrying with them. Then, in fact, the distinction between host and guest proves to be artificial and evaporates in the recognition of the newfound unity. The distinction between host and guest proves to be artificial and evaporates in the recognition of the newfound unity. I love this. Nouwen points at this mystery at the heart of true hospitality, and he emphasizes that true hospitality shouldn't be confused with, you know, this image of soft, sweet kindness, tea parties, bland conversations, and this general atmosphere of coziness. He says that at the heart of hospitality is strangers, often bringing their own fears and hostilities. Strangers who somehow, often with great vulnerability, are able to reveal their gifts to one another. And by revealing themselves, the barriers of guest or host fall away, and we're left with a recognition of our common humanity. We see this kind of hospitality play out near the end of the book of Acts. Paul is sailing to Rome to stand trial before the emperor. And on the way, the boat encounters a massive storm, which shipwrecks the crew on the island of Malta. So they're standing there in the cold rain among the wreckage of their ship and cargo. Paul and the other survivors undoubtedly need help. And they're met by the native Maltese. In the Bible, they're designated by the term barbarian, which only means foreigner and doesn't have the same pejorative term that we use it with now. Paul and the others might well have been afraid, maybe even hostile when meeting these foreigners. And the Maltese probably felt the same way. Yet the writer of Acts notes that the shipwrecked crew were met with unusual kindness or extraordinary kindness by these Gentiles. A fire is quickly built and the survivors are welcomed around it. And this hospitality extends beyond what is encountered on that beach. We hear that the leading man of the island, Publius, who hosts them for 3 days, we see the Maltese, and especially Publius, set aside their own fears and hostilities to offer their gifts to these vulnerable newcomers. In return, Paul heals Publius's father from his fever, along with the rest of the people on the island who had diseases. Paul has moved from a potentially hostile stranger and then to a guest who is able to reveal the promise he is carrying with him, as Nouwen puts it. We hear that as they leave the island, the Maltese bestowed many honors on us. When we were about to sail, they put on board all the provisions we needed. A common humanity was discovered among these strangers through the sharing of gifts and the vulnerability and revelation that comes from this act. And while I've never been shipwrecked, I've certainly experienced this unifying force of hospitality. Much of what I've learned about hospitality comes from the people I encountered at Remera House, a community that welcomes refugee claimants in Toronto. I worked there for 2 years after graduating from the university, and this is also where I first met Cameron. I was really excited about joining this community. It was the only plan that I had following graduating, but I was also really nervous. I knew that I would be working with refugee claimant families, people who had fled their own countries and come to Canada, hoping to convince our government to let them stay. I knew that many of the families I would meet had faced hatred, persecution, and violence in their home countries, and that many were still experiencing grief, anger, and frustration at the many barriers they encountered in Canada. What would I, an inexperienced 22-year-old who had suffered nothing worse than homesickness, ever be able to offer? So with these concerns on my mind, my dad drove me into Toronto on a hot day in August, and after getting a bit lost, we finally found our way to the office, which is on Bloor Street. And sitting just outside the doors of the office were three little girls selling homemade lemonade at a table on the sidewalk. And I noticed right away that it wasn't lemonade, but it was some kind of store-bought fruit punch because the big plastic container was sitting right beside them on the table. Anyway, these girls saw me standing there with my dad, you know, ringing the doorbell at the office, and they wanted to know if I was one of the new interns. Still not really sure who they were, but assuming that they knew Remera House, I said, yep, you know, I am. They jumped up from the table, completely abandoning their business, and almost bowled me over with an enthusiastic six-armed hug. And then they started talking all at the same time, and I caught words like kids club and questions about if I could drive, if I would drive them to the swimming pool, if that man with me was my husband, and if he was also coming to live at Remera House. And so this was my chaotic, jubilant welcome to Remera House. I came to that community as someone who would sort of officially welcome and support newly arrived refugee families. But I was the one who was welcomed and hosted again and again, often by those same newly arrived people. One way this happened was, of course, through meals, the age-old vehicle of hospitality. Workers at Remera House ate supper together every night, and all the families living at Remera House knew this. Yet if you visited someone's apartment anytime after 4 o'clock, it was very likely that you would be offered an entire meal. Snacks of all kinds were offered any time of the day, and from families who were essentially just living on social assistance, usually without even access to a work permit or employment opportunities. The power difference in these interactions, especially around food, often made me uncomfortable in those first few months, and I would often, you know, try to respectfully decline. And I once mentioned this to a woman I was particularly close with. She had come from Guinea a few months earlier and was once again offering me a snack. "I don't want to eat all your food," I joked with her. And she said, "Oh, Erica, in my country, you always make extra rice because you never know who will be coming over to your house." This stunned me. I was encountering an ethic of hospitality that expected usual life and routines to be interrupted by the needs of friends, family, and even strangers. So me and my belly that needed filling wasn't seen as an inconvenience, but an expected opportunity to offer gifts and care. And I soon learned that many, if not most, of the families who came to Romero House came with similar cultural ethics, systems of obligations and communal interdependence that sometimes felt demanding to me. Yet, it gave me a peek into why so many families felt lonely and disconnected, even within the tight community of Romero House. They were used to an entire village of connection and support, usually offered at all hours of the day to anyone. And this is worlds away from our Canadian culture. And it really made me think about our own practices that make this intimate hospitality nearly impossible. I was thinking about our emphasis on privacy, on discreetness, and our outward show of strength and independence. All of these which make it really, really hard to be intimately hospitable with someone. And what I was realizing was that true hospitality, requires vulnerability, often in the face of strangers. And this goes entirely against our own cultural messaging. I'm a child of the 90s, so the common safety message I heard was "stay alert, stay safe," from twin rabbits on hoverboards, Bert and Gert. And those who don't know about these particular PSAs, they're all on YouTube. You should check them out. But they were focused on street-proofing children. So encouraging kids not to walk alone, to be careful about talking to strangers, to never let someone know that you're home alone, that kind of thing. While it tried really, really hard to empower kids, the underlying message was still the same, and it was the panic-filled, you know, stranger danger images of the 70s and 80s. Essentially, strangers are not to be trusted. And of course, now we know that kids are more likely to be harmed by someone they know than abducted off the street by a stranger. And yet our fears of other people, especially people we don't know, continue today. Henry Nouwen notes that fear and hostility are barriers to hospitality. And despite our best intentions, even our really deep desire to be welcoming and open people, especially as people walking along the Jesus path, we do all experience fear and anxieties that prevent us from, as Henry Nouwen puts it, inviting people into our world. And so this really makes me wonder about hospitality in a post-pandemic world. Because let's face it, our anxieties and fears when it comes to other people, they've only increased, or at least mine have. I now cross the street when encountering someone else while out walking. I stand well away from anyone else when I'm standing in any kind of line, and I send passively hostile looks at people who aren't wearing their masks properly. As much as I like to say that I care about people and want to offer hospitality to friends and strangers, my capacity to do this has taken a real hit during the pandemic. And not only do I seem to trust people less, but I'm also less able to handle my own vulnerability. Yet, as we saw, vulnerability, like in the example of Paul in Malta, it's a key ingredient in both the offering and the accepting of hospitality. Jesus, too, gives us a really vivid example of this. In 3 of the 4 Gospels, he sends out his disciples to the surrounding area to proclaim the good news and to cure the sick. And he emphasizes that his disciples should basically take nothing with them when they go. There will be no, you know, stuffed to the brim suitcases with every conceivable outfit for all types of weather. Nope, Jesus doesn't let them take money or a bag or sandals or even a walking stick. Instead, the disciples should enter towns in the fullness of their vulnerability and lack of worldly possessions and accept whatever welcome they're offered. Jesus was encouraging the disciples to lean into their own vulnerability and to trust the people they would encounter and to trust God. As Jennings brilliantly puts it in his commentary on the book of Acts, God is everywhere, waiting for us to arrive. This is a vastly different message than beware of strangers. God is everywhere, waiting for us to arrive. Hospitality demands our vulnerability. It requires that we risk something. And this is the challenge we'll face in our post-pandemic world. At this point, it really does seem that COVID isn't going to leave us suddenly. It's going to fizzle out. It's going to be slow and gradual. We're not going to go straight from lockdown to large gatherings again. It's going to be a long road. And this is going to be our challenge, to slowly start letting go of our COVID fears and hostilities to allow space for hospitality again. But I'm convinced that even if we can't offer physical versions of hospitality right now, and maybe not for a while, I don't think that means we give up on the project entirely. Jennings notes that in the end of the book of Acts, Paul is under house arrest in Rome awaiting trial. But Paul does not languish away with Netflix and booze. No, while he waits, he serves. His prison will not keep him from being a disciple of Jesus and creating the site for the joining of peoples. And I mean, aren't we in kind of a prison too? And how might we circumvent our own prisons, this lockdown, to offer the hospitality that we and our world are so greatly in need of? I think Nouwen has an answer. He says that we should see hospitality as a fundamental attitude towards our fellow human being. It means primarily the creation of a free space where the enemy can enter and become a friend instead of an enemy. The paradox here is that hospitality creates a friendly emptiness where strangers can enter and discover themselves as free. And so here, Nouwen isn't just talking about, you know, your typical stranger, someone that you don't know. He says that even the people in our own homes are strangers in a way. He uses the example of children. And he says, you know, kids are gifts. They're not property. He says, our children are our most important guests who enter into our home, ask for careful attention, stay for a while, and then leave to follow their own way. Children are strangers whom we have to get to know. And I don't know about any of you who are parents, but I certainly felt this way when Levi was born, that suddenly I had this person that I had been anticipating for, you know, my entire pregnancy, but I didn't know him yet. And I've only got to know him more as he's grown. So if even our own family members could be considered guests who need this empty space to reveal themselves and their gifts, then arguably hospitality can be practiced even when we are under a stay-at-home order. And all it requires is a little bit of thinking differently about it. So it requires us to be open to our own vulnerability, willing to accept that, first of all, and open to the inherent strangeness of the people in our lives. I think of this as, like, instead of approaching family members, so in my case, instead of approaching my toddler and my partner as people who I need to control or manipulate to get them to do what I want, how would it be different if I saw them, if we saw our own families, as honored guests who need attention, but they also need the space to reveal their gifts. They need that friendly emptiness, which Nouwen talks about. So when we see hospitality as an attitude, we can actually let the barriers of our roles, parent and sibling, boss and employee, spouses, partners, siblings, we can let all of those dissolve into a new unity, even in our own homes. And I wonder if by practicing this kind of hospitality, we'll be more prepared for welcoming, you know, our traditional strangers as pandemic measures are lifted. I have no doubt that we're still going to be afraid. We're still going to be anxious. It will be challenging to hold this kind of attitude towards other people, especially when we've spent so long avoiding crowds and company generally. But I am convinced that our church, our community, and our own wellness, actually, that all of these require this posture towards one another. We need hospitality, the giving and the receiving of it. And in the meantime, we can continue to be on the lookout for the unusual kindnesses that we might encounter from the strangers we know and the ones we don't. And in the words of Jennings, maybe we can see them for what they actually are. We can see these little bits of kindness as he says, signs of the Spirit's presence with people as a precursor to the holy joining being orchestrated by God. So I hope that gives us something to think about as we start to dream about when the pandemic is over and when we get to all be back together. We might consider what are ways we might start offering hospitality to one another and how can we practice that before we even are able to get together at Nexus again. So looking forward to hearing from all of you. Thank you.